penetrating and perfect dharma is rarely met with even 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you. Thank you. I just finished a 6-day sesshin and was sitting. Sesshin is just sitting. I can't resist giving a testimonial. I feel lighter. I feel like same problems, you know, whatever those are, you know, economic problems, health problems, relationship problems, same problems, but somehow they just don't seem as heavy. So you sit there for 6 days and you just watch these thoughts go through, you know. I mean, I think about sesshin really is kind of burning up karma. You know, whether you store your karma in your body or you store it in your thought process, or most of us store it both. In some ways, you're just sitting there burning it up. It just comes, you know. And yeah, kind of a profound experience. I left early. It's still going on. I felt a little guilty because this morning's the cleanup part. But I worked pretty hard, actually. And last night I was, as I was leaving, I was loading the car up at line 30, and this fellow who had been eating with me, we had a table, and we were doing orioki. And orioki, I've explained that to you a little bit, orioki practice. It's very demanding, actually, and quite elegant and beautiful. It's like tea ceremony, you know, where you have these three little bowls, and you set them out, and you know, it goes back to Tang Dynasty China, and you put your little chopsticks out. But you're all sitting there eating, you know. In this instance, we're eating at a table, and so you're really aware. It's a wonderful exercise in mindfulness, because if you're not mindful, you'll forget. There's a ritual, how you do it. And the ritual is to keep you mindful while you're eating. And if you're space out, you're not going to forget the sequence of it, and when the pots get passed, and how you bow. So most people kind of struggle with it. And this one person at the table, which is this total disaster. I mean, I've seen hundreds of people do orioki, you know. I mean, I did it for 13 years, and I still mess up occasionally, you know. It's like, oh, spaced out. This guy was a disaster. He just could not get it. It was so painful to watch him. It was just like, and then it just half day, usually by the third day, even the most dyslexic person at least gets part of it down. This guy, just one incredible, I asked my wife, who is this guy? He goes, oh, he's a psychiatrist, you know, well known. I said, well, the guy's not stupid. I even went up and said, you know, I have this book. Would you like to read my book? You know, I wanted to save him the embarrassment. It was so embarrassing. And I went up to him and I said, would you like to read the book? And I said, oh, yeah, I just can't get it. He didn't say it at all. He said, oh, this is such a fabulous practice. It is so elegant. And at the end, he was the last. And then he kept getting it wrong, and I kept thinking, he's doing it deliberately. It's his way of being, you know, just like, I'm not going to do this practice. I'm going to show him. I'll just do it the other way. I mean, he was, you know, I just kept watching him. I couldn't believe it. But he was the guy at the end of the practice that grabbed me as I was going. We were just in the dark. And I said, well, it's all, you know, let it go. And he just said, oh, I just couldn't believe it. So fabulous, you know, my heart is so overflowing with gratitude. This guy didn't have a shred of self-criticism, or like it was like transformative, you know, like it just didn't He didn't have to do it perfect. I mean, it was very liberating for me. And I really am, but the session, a lot of people would just be racked with self-doubt, and I can't get it right, and which really goes in a lot of sessions, you know, like, wow. You can't do it right, you know. You know, I'm messing up. And this guy just didn't have any of that. He said, this was such a fabulous. I feel so grateful. And I was actually feeling a little like, God, I don't have as much gratitude as he has. And I've been practicing for 4 years. I was beginning to feel like, when I was driving home last night, I think, like, God, how come I'm not overflowing with gratitude? This guy was like, because I'm just crying. And but then I got up this morning, and what usually happens, not every time, but I feel lighter. I just feel lighter. I just feel lighter. So anyway, it's a testimonial. I'm trying to give you a little testimonial to sign up for the St. Dorothy 3-day retreat. It's not 6 days, but it gives you a taste of just letting the karma go. Don't, you know, go expecting you're going to get some big Kensho enlightening. You may have a great experience like Saul did, or you may just not sure what happened, but if you keep doing it, I guarantee you it'll help you lighten up. Because what are you doing? If you do it, you sit there and you kind of stew in your juice and you just keep letting it go. Try to let it go. And so this was a little different. You know, I do this, I give this to myself once a year because I don't, you probably don't know this, but when I'm doing the St. Dorothy retreat, it's hard. You know, my mind is like I'm doing kind of administrative mind a little bit. Like, what's next? What am I going to say during the Dharma talk? You know, like I go, just try to meditate. But it's, you know, it isn't like just, all I have to do is just sit, follow my breath. So I try to give this to myself, is to be a new student. And, you know, part of me, I have any responsibility. I just usually put myself, they say, well, would you like to do this? And I go, no, I don't want to do any of that. Occasionally I'll do some practice discussions with people that I don't get to see any of the time. But mostly I just put myself on general labor. But this time I actually was feeling a little guilty. I put myself on the kitchen crew as one of the cooks, because that's pretty demanding. You don't get to sit very much. And I'm a little selfish. I'm like, no, I really want to sit. And this, you go through this. You know, you begin to say, well, I don't want to work for other people. I want to sit. This practice is for me. I don't want to have to go in the kitchen and cook for people. And, you know, a lot of people complain about that. You know. And you see that. Everybody in your practice, you begin to, no, less time for me. I now have to sacrifice my time for other people. Well, that's the edge. That's when you're starting to. Of course, there's some people that would rather sacrifice all their time, anything to keep them off the cushion. If you're that kind of person, then you shouldn't sign up for the cooking group. Right? Depends who you are. But so I was trying to be, you know, kind of so we were going to study koans during this practice period. So in this Dharma talk, I'm going to give you two or three slogans. So this slogan is a man of no rank. That's Rinzai's favorite saying. Can you be a person of no rank? Is that part of you that wants status? You know, that wants a position in. What I've noticed is usually when you start off as a new student, you have beginner's mind. It's like you don't care about status. You don't know anything. You know, it's like you don't even want status because you obviously don't know anything. You know, it's embarrassing. So you don't want any rank. But then after you've been practicing a while, there's a certain thing that happens with older practitioners, is they get their ambition starts to come up. They want rank, and you struggle with that. I mean, you know, all we were young monks, monastics, and men and women, and you know, we tried to be a person of no rank, but really, we wanted to be the director, or whatever the position was, the head don, or, you know, deep down inside you wanted that position, and when somebody else got it, you couldn't let go of that. There was something about your, and so you struggled with that for, you know, a long time, actually. There's a koan, which I was going to mention this koan, but since it's apropos, this great koan where one, these two Dharma brothers, they're with this teacher, and one of them leaves and goes and studies with another teacher. And his Dharma brother is like, why did he leave that teacher? And this happens a lot. Actually, you can leave, I'm going to go study with another teacher. But this guy, so he gets his little posse together and he marches over to this other guy's monastery. This guy is the teacher of this monastery now. He says, why? You know, this is insulting. He left our... And so they have... And this teacher that's now was his Dharma brother meets him with his posse. And they have this little Dharma exchange, you know, somewhere. An open ground. And, you know, a little dialogue. And the one... And so the one that left presents this question to him, you know. Well, what about this? You know. No, he said, why? He says, the first one says, why did you leave? And the one that left says, well, I just didn't get it. Whatever the person said, I just wasn't getting it. And then he says, for example, this question. And he presents a question and the challenger comes up and gives sort of this standard Zen, you know, in a lot of these koans, it's like whatever answer you give is going to be right? Because if you say this, it's only part of the answer. If you say this, it's only part of the answer. And you know that, I mean, in Suzuki Roshi's book, not always so. That's what we're getting you to try to see. You know, whatever you come up with is only part of the answer, right? Form is part, emptiness is part, it's just part. Whatever you say is going to be partially true and partially false. So the standard, one of the standard Zen answers is, you know, you don't say anything. Or you take your, you know, the little stick that I have, you know, you hold the stick up, boom, that's the answer. You know, I'm not going to say anything verbally. And he says, well, yeah, that's what your teacher, that's what our old teacher said. And he said, that wasn't good enough for me. What do you say? And there was a way he did that where the challenger was stumped, which is often what happens. And so what he did, he just said, well, you're right, I don't get it. He disbanded the temple, he stopped being a teacher, and he went to study with his Dharma brother because he felt his realization was better. So in some ways he was able to step into that place. He was able to step into that place of being a man of no rank. He could give up being this abbot of this monastery and just go back to being a student again for a while. Maybe he became it, we don't know. Did he become a teacher again? Sometimes they end up being great teachers, but we don't know. He just gave it up and disbanded the monastery and went to study with his Dharma brother, man of no rank. So that's what that particular koan teaches us, something about being a man of, usually we see it when we want rank and status. So, you know, I've been practicing 45 years, so I'm not quite there yet. I still get caught. But I can see, it's good to go in another practice center and see how much people are caught by that. And how much they're working with it. And people that have stepped beyond that. So it's an interesting thing for me to observe. So when I was sitting, I was reminded of, there's a wonderful poet, you may know her, Jane Hirschfield, who's a Dharma, also a Dharma, my Dharma sister, and has wonderful, writes wonderful poetry. And she has one poem that says, she says, three things. You can summarize Zen practice, three things. Everything changes. Everything is connected. And be present. That's it. That pretty much sums it up. pretty simple, not all this stuff that I talk about. Everything changes. Everything is connected. So please try to take care and love everything. Everything is connected. And you've got to be present to realize that. And that's really what Teshin is about. It's like our ancestors devised this incredible thing, meditation, you know, where we all get together and we support each other to notice that everything changes. And so you're sitting there in meditation and really secretly you really want some Satori or Kensho experience or some sense of illuminating light or the unity of oneness, or and you will. You know, if you sit long enough, you will have some of those experiences. I didn't have many this time. Mostly what I had was a lot of experience of thoughts. Lots of thoughts. It was amazing to me the divergent variety of thoughts that would come through my mind. And for a long time you think, well, this is crazy, I'm not meditating, right? You know, my mind is just, although I had quite a bit of space between thoughts too, which is helpful. A lot of times you don't have much space. But I was struck by the profundity of how important these thoughts are. Because how else are you going to learn about impermanence, that everything changes? That these thoughts go through, and you'll be thinking about what's for lunch, and then, you know, the next minute you'll be thinking about, you'll be grieving your mother, and the next minute you'll be thinking about where you put your iPhone, and where do these thoughts come from, you know? What? And after a while, you just begin to have a sense of humor about them. Really. It's like, this is just bubbles in a glass of champagne. You know, it's just the nature of the mind to create these waves. And if you watch them long enough and you don't stir up or get hooked by them, they're just these waves, and you begin to have a sense of humor about the whole thing. They just don't quite push you around as much. And you just sit and do that. We sit on our cushion and we practice dropping our thoughts. But you do need to pay attention, and you need to catch it, and you need to practice dropping. And you begin to get increasing awareness. In fact, everything changes. Everything changes. You don't have to hang on to anything. You can lighten up and let go. And then there's more space for people. You know, more space for all things to advance forward and illuminate you, inspire you, everything, because you're not so self-absorbed. So it's kind of interesting, you know? You watch your thoughts, seems like you're quite self-absorbed with that process, but then by letting them go, some gaps, some space opens up. And then, so she's kind of wonderful because you begin to see that we're all connected, because there's more space, but also it's quite wonderful. In Sesshin, you begin to notice how everybody is working so hard. You know, I couldn't believe it. You know, the Tenzo, and who's the head cook, you can see why they're often a more advanced practitioner, because, I mean, she didn't even, you know, we weren't paying her. She actually paid to come to the retreat to cook for us. Couldn't believe it. She hardly had any chance to sit on a cushion. She had to sit there and think and worry and be concerned about whether the food was going to get out on time or not. It's a very advanced, very selfless practice. So I threw myself in as one of the ancillary cooks, you know, just to be able to experience a little of that. And yes, people feel a tremendous, you feel a tremendous sense of gratitude about all these people. And then you realize, unless you're an extremely disciplined person, it's very hard to sit. I think almost impossible to sit 6, 7, you know, 8, 9, there's actually 10 half-hour periods a day. But when you're sitting with other people and you feel these other people's effort, And mostly, in some of the pretty older people, there are two people, three people in their 80s. There's a woman that sat right next to me, who I know a little bit, who's autistic. And it is hard to be, when you're autistic, it is hard to be in that body. You are so sensitive to sound and light. So here's another koan for you. I don't remember which one this is, but it's one of my favorite phrases. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Do you know that one? Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. It comes from an old, I think it even goes predates Buddhism, but somebody was asking, I can't remember one teacher, how it was with their sickness. Quite a few koans about that. How's your sickness? How are you doing? And the teacher's answer was sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, which is pretty much what our practice tries to teach us. Is that suffering comes when we're trying to adjust a lot. We're trying to get everything to fit our idea about how it ought to be. And the sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha means that is when you sit on the cushion, you just kind of accept what comes to you. You can't control how your body feels so much. There's only so much you can do to adjust your posture. And what can you do about your thinking other than just let things go and accept them? If you contract around them and you try to control the pain in your body and in your mind, you'll see you just suffer even more. So when the third patriarch says, another variation on sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, which is, the great way is not difficult. Just avoid picking and choosing. So that's a wonderful koan for you to turn, because we're always picking and choosing, right? But how do you find, in the midst of the picking and choosing of your life, how do you find that way where you are kind of free of that? So in Sesshin and on our cushion, we're always practicing with our preferences, not having preferences. Trying not to have. And of course, we're constantly making preferences. So we sat in the same room, our last retreat. We sat at Angela Center, and we sat in that same room. And Angela Center just neglected to tell us that it was football season. You'd think when you sign up for a six-day retreat that they would have mentioned that there was a full-blown football game on right outside the meditation at night that went on with the loudspeakers. So we're sitting there meditating and hearing the Dharma talk where you can hear, and it's the fourth down and five to go, and they just made a 54-yard touchdown, and the whole stands are erupting. We're right in the middle of this. It felt like we were right in the middle of the stadium. So talk about, and then for some reason, the rooms are either, incredibly hot, like 85, or they were like freezing. And so people were upset about that, right? So my question, which I was supposed to present this morning, the one I came up with was, and I gave it to everybody at the last work meeting because I wasn't going to be there. I said, we had a little ceremony where you present the question, just like we do at the end of our practice period. So my question was, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Rooms too hot, rooms too cold. Too much noise for some, not enough noise. How does a bodhisattva, and when does a bodhisattva complain? So that's the question, right? I don't know what Arnold would have said, but I'm turning that personal tone. When do you make that adjustment? How do you make it? And what's your state of mind when you're making the adjustment? Is it a part of you still practicing with no preferences? No preferences? Or a great way is not difficult if you avoid picking and choosing. And then can you choose? can you then make some choice, but with some lighter state of mind? So, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, whatever comes. So here's another, this is not a koan, this is from the Lojong teaching. This is another very helpful slogan. So I'm giving you these koans because they're really stories, they're parables to steer your life by. When you get in difficult situations, you can reach down and maybe pull one of these stories up. So here's a slogan we haven't studied yet, but it's very, very helpful. Don't be so predictable. So this is one of the 59, 7 points of mind training, the 59 slogans. Don't be so predictable. So notice when those ways you try to adjust yourself, you try to get the world to adjust towards you, you have very predictable ways to do that. So notice the ways that you do that, the ways you create, begin to create suffering, and then just try not to be so predictable. So when you think about somebody that's giving you some problem, and you're going through your usual litany about why you don't like them, don't be so predictable. Try to be more generous, right? Or if you are, you tend to have two helpings of food, you really need two helpings, or you need two glasses of wine in the evening, don't be so predictable. Just, why don't you just take one?
Or four.
That's right. That maybe some people that would be good to do that. I agree. Don't be so predictable. Try to change it. Move into your comfort level a little bit. So that's what practice periods are about. Trying to move into our comfort zone a little bit. Don't be so predictable. Find a way when you're very predictable about something. Try to shift it a little bit. Everything changes. We're all connected. But you've got to be present. You have to have some kind of practice, like meditation practice, to keep you on the present moment. And we have some tools, your breath, your body. And you find when you're sitting in Sesshin that you're really there with your body. The mind is happening, but in some ways you have to sit long enough where there's discomfort and the body comes up. And that's, not an accident that you sit long enough. It forces you to feel your body. Because our body, we don't move away. Our practice is very much a body practice. More and more research, people think, we really, if we're honest, we think our body is just something that carries around our mind or carries around our personality. It's just a vehicle for our personality and our mind. But you get beyond that in meditation and practice. You see how connected you are. And if you stay with your body, you stay with your breath and the sensations of your body, the mind begins to abate. As you move into a more body consciousness, and your breath, your belly, the mind begins to abate. You see that your mind isn't just driving your body. The body, in some ways, has a tremendous effect on the mind. And it begins to calm a little bit. So when Buddha, the statue in Mahayana, in Zen, is Shakyamuni Buddha, touching the earth, grounding earth. So we connect through our body with the earth and with everybody. And we have to have some physical sense about how that is. So maybe that's enough slogans for today. Don't be predictable. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, and Rinzai's a person of no rank. So, let's see. Practice period is happening. I'm going to start signing people up for practice discussion. That's helpful. hopefully for you, for me, certainly for me, it inspires me. So we'll do some here on Sunday, some we'll do on Thursday morning meditation. If you want a longer period when I email you, just say you'd like something longer and we'll arrange a longer meeting, you know, at my home office. And I'd also like to do some teas this time, which are really helpful. I think the next one we'll do is on the third Thursday when we have a little longer time. Like there'll be a tea today, just a social tea for all of us, but on the third I'll remind you, maybe we'll do it here, we'll have a little informal one, and people in the practice period, we'll just go around and say, how are you doing? How's your practice going? And we can inspire each other, have a little longer time to talk. You know, I won't say much, I just want to hear how you're working with your slogan, you know, what you came up with during your practice period. Okay. We have a few minutes left. Let's do a service. Let's do the harmony of difference and equality. We haven't done that one for a while.